Let me call this meeting to order. This is our second meeting of our integration revenue work group. Welcome everyone to this group, and we will start. First of all, I just want to set some rules. Today we are going to have two guest speakers. We are going to listen to their presentation, and then if our work group panel has some questions, they will be able to ask them. I'm asking just the group to ask questions today. We at our third meeting will be having the districts come on out, and folks that want to do a brief interview with the working group, at that time those questions can be asked. So we're going to hold off until our third group discussion, so that way we can go through these interviews with our two special guests today. First of all, I just want to go real quickly and you'd say your name and your district, and then we'll proceed on. So if you want to start here.
Okay, State Representative Bud Heidgerken from Central Minnesota, representing 13 school districts, of which Sauk Center is perhaps the largest.
Mindy Riley, Roseville, Moundsview, and St. Anthony, New Brighton School District.
Deborah Hilstrom, Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park. I have Osseo, Robbinsdale, and Anoka, Hennepin, and Brooklyn Center School District.
Carlo Floriani, St. Paul.
And we also have staff.
Okay. I'm Shannon Tatzik. I'm the Committee Administrator for the College K-12 Finance Division.
And I'm Brad Kelly with House K-12 Research.
Carmen Carter with House Republican Research.
I'm Tim Strom with House Research.
Lisa Larson with House Research.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much. Our first presentation is going to be by Cindy Lavarato. I hope I got that right. She's currently the professor at the University of St. Thomas. Prior to that, she was served as assistant commissioner at the Department of Education, and also served 16 years at the State Attorney General's office when the integration revenue was being put in place. So, welcome to our committee, and thank you very much for taking your time to have a presentation here with our committee. We're going to turn it over to you, and you have, I guess, about a half hour to do your presentation. So welcome again, and if you would please say your name for the record.
Certainly. Again, my name is Cindy Lavarato, and that's spelled L-A-V-O-R-A-T-O. Thank you, committee members, for the opportunity to address you. I was somewhat under the impression that we were going to have a discussion as opposed to a presentation, but I will, as any lawyer, I can stand up here and talk as long as you want me to, and then just tell me to be quiet. So I think the purpose of the invitation for me was the fact that I had quite a bit to do with the researching and drafting of the current desegregation rule that was the impetus for the integration revenue statute that I believe you're studying. And I've had a chance over the years to talk to the legislative auditor as they were reviewing the impact of that integration revenue statute. I've talked to members of the Department of Education, tried to keep current on the case law in this area, and I think you were provided perhaps yesterday or this morning with a copy of a paper that I presented at Oxford University a couple of years ago about the status of integration efforts in this country at this time and what some of the benefits of our integration rule, what I believe some of the benefits of our integration rule could be. A brief history of the rule, it was the impetus for this rule, I think you could trace it to about 1989 when a group of, I think it was the Women's League of Voters, did a study on the increasing racial isolation of some of the urban districts and began to make recommendations about the fact that our then current integration or desegregation rule, rather, was not doing what it should be doing in terms of racial balance. The demographics, as I'm sure Myron's going to get into, the demographics of our urban areas have changed dramatically since our first rule was enacted in the late 70s, and at that point in 1989, it really was no longer functional. And so people were taking a look at what they might do in order to make it more functional given the demographics. A number of proposals came forward from about 1989 until about 1995, including a suggestion by a roundtable that was commissioned by the state legislature, I believe. A number of drafts were circulated by the State Board of Education, and then in 1995, shortly after a Supreme Court ruling that narrowly limit the ability to use race as a factor in governmental programs, the Attorney General's office was engaged to take a look at the proposals and to review them for legality, and along with the graduation rule and the diversity rule that were then being developed. And in the process of that study, we held many hearings, and I went to many different constituencies around the state and with the state board, gathered a lot of information, and did a lot of sociological research about integration efforts and the extent to which they've been successful, and most particularly the extent to which integration could be tied to academic achievement. And what the research revealed at that time and reveals even more so today is that while integration is a certainly a laudable social goal, it probably isn't a reason. You shouldn't do integration in the hopes it's going to improve academic achievement. It just, the data does not suggest that in any substantive way at all. So given that, we decided at the Attorney General's office, I didn't work on this alone, I worked on it with many other colleagues, that we really wanted to promote the notion of the value of integration. But legally, we were hamstrung given the Supreme Court's position on the use of race as a factor. And so what we turned to and what we ultimately promulgated was a rule that focuses not so much on racial balance. It focuses on the opportunity for students to have contact with other students of different racial and ethnic backgrounds in order to foster a greater sense of understanding, tolerance, acceptance, with the notion that that's really, really at least half of what integration efforts are about. They really ought to be about helping people develop their cultural competence, helping people understand that they need to work and live together in a pluralistic society. How can we do that if we can't use race as a factor, an overt factor, in making school assignments? Well, the rule suggests that the most effective way to do that would be to come up with programs that are proposed by the communities affected, and programs that allow those communities to identify what they believe to be the integration concerns in their relative districts and to come up with plans that address those integration issues. That's why the rule allows for a variety of ways to accomplish what is the objective of the rule, which is not racial balance, as I think many people understand. It is not racial balance. In fact, if you take a look at the enabling legislation permitted the state board to define racial balance, and we were very careful to define it as increased opportunities for interracial contact, not a quota. And so I do think that the rule provides the mechanism for communities to come together and define how they want to accomplish that objective, and the integration revenue statute, which I was really not so much involved in, provides the necessary revenue for any sort of program that you're going to have any sort of success with. So that's, in a nutshell, what the history of this rule was and what the legal and sociological context for the rule was at the time that it was promulgated. Did I talk too fast and give you way too much there?
No.
You available for questions?
I certainly am.
Thank you. Representative Greiling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lavorato, could you comment on the recommendations in the Legislative Auditor's Report? And particularly, I'm interested in the uses of the funding of integration revenue and the fact that some districts like Minneapolis are using it for class size reduction in order to prevent white flight. And then some districts, more greater Minnesota districts, have used it for new textbooks that perhaps might be more multicultural. But what is your recommendation or opinion on those uses?
I think the purpose of the rule, as I said, was not to achieve racial balance so much as it was to increase the opportunities for interracial contact. And if you take, I'm going to give you a long answer to your question.
Okay.
If you take a look at the measures that are suggested in the rule, it provides a number of different alternatives, from staff development to programs that enable students to come together either during school or after school. So the answer would be that I believe that the appropriate purposes of that revenue would be to foster the original intent of the rule, which is to provide opportunities for interracial contact. Do textbooks in and of themselves do that? I guess I would have to see what the overall plan was. It's really important that when the Department of Education is taking a look at whether or not to fund a particular plan, that they look at not pieces of it, but the overall plan. Is the textbook intended to promote some greater outcome in the context of the plan, or is it just the textbook? Or I've heard complaints that some districts are just using the integration revenue for what has been termed as candy. I don't know what is exactly meant by that, but I think it would be easy to pick certain provisions of a desegregation plan and say this isn't good. But I think it's first of all very important to take a look at what's being funded in the overall context of the desegregation plan that's being proposed, and then make a judgment about whether it's appropriate or not. Is class size an appropriate allocation of that money? I don't know without looking at the overall plan. Perhaps reduced class size was a part of a plan to attract a diverse population to the particular school in question. It could be a perfectly appropriate use of the money, but it depends on the context. Does that answer your question, Representative Freiland?
Not really.
Okay. were you looking for a yes or no answer?
Yes,
or?
Yes, I was.
If you want, you know, let me just back up and say that the whole notion of this, and maybe you don't buy it as a policy, but the whole notion of this was not to prescribe for school districts what your integration issues are and how you want to address them. The notion was that you involve the communities in that discussion so that you have a more representative product when the plan is proposed. That it isn't a district or a state mandate that we do it this way versus that way. There is no magic bullet for this particular issue. There are lots of different approaches. There are lots of ways to do it wrong. But I don't know that there's any particular absolute way to do it right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grady.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Lavorato. And to be more serious, I am a defender of integration funding, and I would like to keep it and justify it. And so I'm therefore very sympathetic with the recommendations in the auditor's report that seem to be trying to keep it but tighten it up so we can defend it. And so if we have it, you know, you can just kind of use it for this or that or the other thing, and the perception then is, and I share that perception, that maybe it's not really being used for fostering the tolerance and acceptance and contact with students of color and white students that it was originally intended for. And that's why I've had concerns about using it for purposes that any district would like extra money for, and then they look jealously at it and wonder, well, why do they get it if I don't? And they're using it for new textbooks or lower class size, and we need those too. And really, what are they doing that has anything to do with integration? And that's why I have, I agree the overall plan would give more integrity to the yes or no and black and white uses. But we haven't really seen that kind of oversight of the overall plan from the Department of Education. And now apparently they're trying to regroup and do some things better. And at the last meeting, we had a couple of new people here who were couldn't be blamed for past transgressions, conveniently, but so they were new. But yet, how are we as legislators to put a little more teeth into our statutes in order to ensure that when they're gone or that they keep up having some oversight? And that's what why we're looking at the auditor's report. So I wondered, so I didn't get a lot of direction from you on, should we change the statute or does it work if we just had better Department of Education oversight?
Well, you know, you're asking somebody who was really involved in the drafting of it, so of course I'm going to say it's not the policy, it's the implementation.
Yeah.
I was at the department for the first year and a half that this rule was operational, and we were only allocated one staff member to work on it. After I left, the staff struggled valiantly with about three-quarters of a person staffed to do this work. If you take a look at the Statement of Need and Reasonableness that we drafted at the time the rule was promulgated, we estimated at that time that it would take three full-time staff to effectively implement this policy. You know, you can have the best policy in the world, but if you don't have the resources and the staff to implement it, it's not going to work. My view is that this is a, if you accept the premise that we're not trying to achieve racial balance, because if you look at the demographics, I don't think that's a realistic goal anymore. And I'm not sure that's achieved the objective. And we don't have a lesser gap between white students and students of color. We don't have greater racial balance, not just in the Twin Cities, but around the country. So maybe we need to focus on something a little different. Maybe we need to focus on not so much what the numbers are, but what we do with the students who are there. And that's what I think this rule is intended to do. So if you accept that premise, then I think that this is actually a very progressive rule that has a lot of potential. But it just never got funded and staffed the way I would like to have seen it be funded and staffed. And I think, you know, I've talked to some of the previous administrators at the Department of Education. I know them. I worked with them. And I'm not sure they ever accepted the premise that this rule is not about racial balance and racial quotas. And so if that's where you're coming from, then the emphasis you're going to place on it, and that's how everything else is going to flow from it. And so if you have a misplaced idea of what this thing is about, and you don't have staff to deliver on the implementation, it's probably not going to be effective. Do I think we ought to scrap it? I don't. I really would like to see this given a chance. I'd like to see it fully implemented. I'd like to see it fully staffed. I'd like to see a Department of Education staff that has the wherewithal and the courage to take a look at boundary lines and the way they're drawn and make a decision about whether there's some aspect of intentional segregated intent going on, because the rule provides them that authority and that ability to enforce the law. I would really like to see the Department of Education take a hard look at some of these plans and say yes or no. This funding in the context of the plan makes sense. It furthers the overall purpose. Most importantly, what I would like to see, and this has never been done as far as I can tell, the rule provides that I'm going to blank on the years now, but it seems to me that every 2 years for schools that were racially isolated and every 4 years for cooperating districts, those districts and schools receiving money were to provide an evaluation of the extent to which their integration efforts were realized. And then the Department of Education was to provide a report and an evaluation to you, the legislators, about that, and make a recommendation about whether they were doing what they should be doing or whether they maybe should take a different direction. That's never been done either, as far as I know. So the whole tail end of this policy was never effectuated, and I think that the oversight exists there. But again, having it on paper and having somebody actually do it are really two different things.
Representative Highgarden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Some comments and a question, Ms. Labrador. I know that last year the Pioneer Press had an article 2 years ago on more diversity dollars moving to suburbs, and it followed up a little bit on where some of the funding was going. But some of the problems they're having there is that some of the schools are spending a lot of these monies for pieces of art, things of this sort, that weren't even going into the classroom. Now, I don't really have a problem, Representative Grinding, with if it's being spent on textbooks. I taught school last Friday in a very, very rural district where one of the classes is using textbooks from the 70s yet. And again, there's lack of funds out there. And again, textbooks is one of the things that oftentimes will be overlooked. But yet, at the same time, I've read most of your report here. My printer broke down at home, so I didn't get it all read. But I'm a little bit concerned about, at the same time, of where your report is going. You mentioned that the focus is on allowing students to be in contact with other students and other minorities, working together for understanding things of this sort. But right now, the way it is, you do not want, you say that the result is not necessarily racial balance, but at the same time, I think we're going the other way. We're promoting racially imbalance. We're promoting segregation. We're promoting, whether it be with Latino students or whatever. Right now, we had, I referred to and I alluded to in the past, a situation in Duluth that has a very small percentage of protected students. But being that they have one site that has a high concentration, they qualify for these funds. At the same time, within my legislative district, we have one school that, up until this year, had 40% protected students, first, second, third, and fourth grade, not qualifying for any of these funds. Now, they had just closed the building up, and one of the questions they asked me would be, all right, if we sent these protected students to that site, that way we get these funds. I mean, but that's what we're promoting as the system works, as it is in play. At the same time, I have a problem with a certain school district has two protected students, and they qualify for these funds. And it doesn't make sense when you've got the Representative Hillstrom. Her district has a very high concentration, a very large number. And most certainly your district should be getting some of these funds. And those are, that's where I think what we need to really look at. Right now, the system that is in play is not working, and I know I've met with Senator Pogramore on this as well. But it's something that we have to look at very seriously. At the same time, try to make the dollars work where they should be working. So just a comment.
I don't know if you would like me to respond or not.
It's up to you.
I think it's important to take a look at the different pieces of the funding formula to see whether, in fact, the funding formula is disincenting integration, as I think you're suggesting that it does in some cases. For instance, part of a district's ability to get funding is just whether they want to volunteer to participate in the program. As I recall, that was the result of some lobbying and some political pressure on behalf of some pretty successful districts. I wasn't in favor of that. I mean, the fact that you want to sign up and be part of the group and maybe get some of the money may be a good reason to do it, maybe not. But I'm totally with you on the notion that you ought to look at those pieces of the statute that really don't, that may actually disincent integration efforts. I totally agree with you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You alluded to this, or maybe even spoke about it, but it's my understanding that just because you have a plan doesn't mean that you actually need to implement it to get the money, and maybe it doesn't even necessarily have to have results. Could you talk a little bit more about that? I represent Osseo School District, which is, you know, very segregated on one half of the district versus the other, and I represent the more diverse half of the district. So if you could talk about that a little more, that would be helpful.
Well, your question is it true that the rule doesn't require districts to use the money for what they say they're going to?
Well, isn't part of the plan to actually say how you're going to implement to make things better, and in the event you use the resources and it has no impact, or you can't measure it or don't measure it, you really don't know. isn't that what you kind of said earlier?
Well, I think what I intended to say is that the way the rule is supposed to work is, let's just take the case of a racially isolated school for purposes of ease. That school creates a working group of stakeholders to identify what they believe the particular integration issues are at that school. They come up with a plan to address those issues. The plan should also specify how they're going to measure whether or not the plan is working. So, at the point where 2 years goes by, the school district is then to take a look at what were the goals, what do we do, what do we use the money for, what were the outcomes, and report that to the department. The department is then supposed to take a look, make an independent evaluation of whether, in fact, those goals were met and the outcomes were effective, and make a report to the legislature. So there is a process of accountability. It's just not being used.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. In my neighborhood school in particular, we have a large number of apartments, and it has actually become more and more diverse as the time has gone on, even though everyone has known that this school is a racially isolated district. But it's more about the makeup of the community around it rather than what the school district is or isn't doing. Is that supposed to be taken into account as well in these plans? Or?
Well, yes, because part of the reason that I'm not a fan of saying you measure the success of this by the racial balance in any particular school is because the ability of a school, as you're suggesting, the ability of a school to actually impact the racial balance of its student population is not ultimately or even imminently under its control. It is subject to a variety of other factors. And so I would say that if the legislature, as a policy matter, wants to go after racial balance and integration by numbers, then you ought to be looking at, pardon me, I don't mean to be telling you how to do your job, but it seems to me that the more appropriate inquiry would be, well, what are those other factors that are beyond the ability of schools and school districts to control, and how can we address those factors rather than making the districts and the schools solely accountable for this integration effort? It's not realistic, I don't think.
Any more questions of the panel? Representative Mariani.
Thank you.
Welcome,
Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is a question, just more kind of wrestling with a whole bunch of stuff here. It's good to see you again.
Nice to see you too, Representative Mariani.
I was just saying, I don't know if this is more a question or more just kind of thinking out loud here, and I'm kind of more, for these kind of hearings, I'm more interested in kind of a loose conversation of back and forth, because I'm wrestling with a whole bunch of issues here. One is that independent of Supreme Court parameters, and of course we can't be independent of them, but nonetheless, independent of them, my view of reality is that we have highly segregated communities, and they play themselves out in a number of ways, including in our public education system. And I am persuaded by a lot of the, you know, historical and social research that even though we can split hairs between what's really de jure and de facto segregation, that we've got all sorts of communities in the last few decades that have been created, largely driven by a desire for folks to separate themselves according to race. And so, you know, in the inner city, we talk about white flight, for instance. And so I struggle with, this is not me picking a bone with you. I suppose it's picking a bone with the Supreme Court that has got to be seeing the same thing I see, but has come down with a legal construct that says that the Equal Protection Clause says you can't use race except for very limited circumstances. And those circumstances just, you know, don't give me as a lawmaker, a policymaker, the kind of room that I think I need to have in order to not create some equality in our society. But that's just kind of an angst I have. I mean, that's not an issue with you. I think that, you know, we could pick different points to have this conversation, and one is, to, in fact, to go back to the U.S. Supreme Court and how we chose as a state to interpret that. And I'm not a lawyer. I'm not sure that the Supreme, that there isn't more room there than we thought there could be. And of course, there continues to be decisions. There was a decision just handed down this year that put some more prescriptions. But I think it's worth our efforts to explore whether or not we might have erred back when we were putting together the current law in terms of our interpretation of what the Supreme Court allowed and didn't allow. I suspect that Mr. Orfield will talk a little bit about that when we get a chance to talk to him about it. But let me pick a different spot here, and this is just a structural, spot. The way the rule is written, it results in a variety of approaches because we put a value on a local community, design for something that matches their realities and their needs. But it seems to me that therefore also then built kind of an inherent weakness in the overall rule, and that is that as a lawmaker sitting on this side, what that tells me is that we don't really have a focus in terms of a major policy goal as lawmakers. That those outcomes are going to be pretty what they are, pretty scattered, shotgun type of stuff. That in the end doesn't give us as a state a definitive ability to say, this is what we're trying to do. Me as a lawmaker, this is what I want to do with the state rule. Because all I can really say is, this is what I want to do, and here's 100 different ways in which people, and we're getting to, to the point where that report came down, that you identified some of the weaknesses, and Representative Hillstrom has identified some others. Well, you've got some pretty bizarre, I think, funding of efforts, but largely because we don't have a focus. So that's one issue, and then the other, and then I'll stop and let you ruminate on it. And this is really more a question for us and less for you, I suppose. You said that there was no data that supported in the research that you were doing, and I was involved with you back then. I know you were very diligent about that, tying integration to academic achievement. We've then settled on programs that can help develop cultural competence. What does the data tell us about those kind of programs connected to academic achievement? And I guess I'm not giving up on the idea that there is a paradigm here that we try to develop that has a nexus between integration and academic achievement. Maybe that's an open-ended question. I know you didn't come prepared with all the data here, but I think it's a begging question for us. If the state says our goal then is developing cultural competency, is there any data that also tells us, or that tells us that in and of itself can be a contributing factor to academic achievement, which increasingly is what motivates us and directs us in terms of anything we do here with public education? You know, we want to see test scores go up, we want to see more people go to college, etc. So anyway, I'll stop there. I threw out a lot of stuff there, and it's not so much for you as much as it's also for the committee to be chewing on things.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Is there a response to some of his
questions? I could certainly weigh in, unless some of the other members of the committee would like to respond first. Okay. Let me take the last one first, if I might. I've not seen sociological data that links cultural competence with improved academic achievement. I've not done that research. I've done a lot of general research about the fact that it's very, very, very difficult to isolate what impacts academic achievement. There's so many variables, which is parenthetically why I have a struggle with No Child Left Behind. They're just to say that we're going to be able, well, I won't go there. I won't go there.
We'll have another hearing and do that.
You can't really say, right now, as I understand the literature, the greatest predictor of a child's academic achievement is going to be mom's educational background, then teacher effectiveness, then socioeconomic factors, none of which has anything to do with cultural competence, particularly. So no, I haven't seen the evidence that links those two phenomena. But what I have seen is evidence that says greater cultural competence gives kids who are racially isolated and interaction, not only just competence, but greater interaction between the races, gives kids that are otherwise racially isolated better access to the networks that we all know that exist in order to get ahead in life. It's one of the reasons why I think the Supreme Court, when it decided the law school case, the Grutner decision, said, you know what, for purposes of law school, we're going to say diversity is a compelling interest, because we know how important it is for the future leaders of America to get together in law school and talk and network and do those things. Unlike, I guess, law schools must be really special because they didn't permit the use of that precedent in any other context yet. But anyhow, I think there are ways to measure positive outcomes from increased interracial contact. And I think if you take a look at businesses, And the business model, which focuses like in our School of Business at the University of St. Thomas, they focus tremendously on developing cultural competence because the workplace is seeking individuals who know how to function in a diverse and pluralistic society. So I think to see us get totally hung up on the connection between academic achievement and what we're doing. The universe is bigger than, easy for me to say, but the universe is bigger than test results. And I think we need to be forward-looking enough to be able to say, you know what, we really want people who are competent and comfortable living in a diverse society and know how to navigate with people from different backgrounds and from different religions and, can work effectively in a diverse environment. To me, that is a very laudable and worthwhile goal in and of itself. Along with the fact that the data also suggests that long-term it provides economic benefits for students who are racially isolated. So that was a long answer to your last question.
Oh, that's good.
I can't remember. It's in this paper somewhere that I gave you. The data is in there. I can take a look at it and get back to you to point it out. And there are a lot of sociological studies that demonstrate that connection. That may or may not be referenced in there. Let me go back to your first question, which was, did we construe the Supreme Court precedent regarding use of race as a factor in school assignments too narrowly? I don't think so. I think the recent Seattle decision suggests that we did not. But let me just add one little wrinkle here. The rule doesn't say that you cannot use race as a factor.
Right.
It just doesn't say you must. So districts, if they feel that they want to go that route, certainly have, they can certainly do that. We just didn't want to say, as a state, you must use race as a factor, and we're going to measure your effectiveness by whether you achieve a magical quota, because we were pretty certain that that would be challenged and struck down. And let me throw this out. There's nothing worse than being an aggressive policymaker on the cutting edge and then having some court say, no. You can't do that. That's illegal. I mean, that just sets your policymaking back years and years and years. So what we tried to do was dance around. I mean, it's a tightrope. We tried to dance around the Supreme Court precedent and yet give districts some flexibility in terms of how they wanted to proceed. So they may use it. It's just not a must. Mm-hmm. And then I think your second question had to do with what is our primary policy objective? What's our focus for this? And I guess what I might suggest is that some discussion be undertaken about the purpose of the rule, because there is a purpose section, and I believe there's about 7 different provisions in that purpose section, one of which references academic achievement, and I didn't want that in there because I didn't think the data supported it, but, you know, I wasn't the only one. I wasn't queen, so I didn't get to have my way. But there are about 7 different purpose statements in that rule, and perhaps it would be helpful to focus on those and decide, you know, okay, what are we really after here now? If it isn't racial, if it is racial balance, how do we want to do that? If it isn't racial balance, if it's cultural competence, if it's equal educational opportunity, well, you know, let's focus on that. I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Oh, it helps. I mean, it's really an open-ended discussion in many ways for us, because I think what we're doing is just, you know, backing up and pausing and asking as many questions as we should be asking in terms of whether we have an effective statute here, and then also whether or not we're clear about, you know, what the purpose of the statute is. I am struck, though, by your, I don't want to leave that just, you know, not commented on, the expectation of the drafters and of the legislature when it adopted it in language that asks for, or actually, I guess, requires periodic evaluation, and also apparently requires a department function to gather those and report those back. And I've been here for a few years, but I've never heard that report. And so I think one of the things we should, you know, as we continue this exploration, is seriously consider, is in fact to exercise some legislative, you know, diligence here in requesting that the department, you know, comply with the expectations that we put into law for it. And there may be all sorts of reasons why they haven't, including underfunding issues, but the point is the expectation exists in law. And without that, you know, without any evaluation of anything, you're having a discussion that's partly uninformed. So anyway, I didn't want to leave that hanging.
I think it's, pardon me for interrupting, but I just wanted to respond. And I think it was a key part of the rule because it did permit so many different approaches. We didn't want there to be this candy money effect. Without the evaluation and the reporting and the accountability at the end of it, unfortunately, that's kind of how it may have gone out.
Thank you. Representative Heinberger.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and to your comments, Representative Mariani. And I think that if you do some checking, I think most schools are doing a pretty good job with those funds. I know, just looking at an article I read, what schools are doing. For example, South Washington has a program where they've hired some integration specialists with those funds, and they've also promoted an extended day kindergarten. Mm-hmm. Over at Cottage Grove, they're using a multicultural component there. West St. Paul, Mendota Heights, and Egan schools have added 20 minutes of Spanish each day. And they said the children are going home speaking Spanish. And I think the Spanish-speaking students feel more connected. I know that's working in a couple school districts in my particular district. We also have West St. Paul, the Project Common Ground, which brings together students and teachers from different cultures and groups in St. Paul and 9 suburban schools. So there's a lot of good things going forth at the same time. And I think if you look at the auditor's report, I think that's where a lot of the auditor's report brought up the idea that we're not doing it right. We're not spending the money properly. And I think that's where we need to spend most of our time on. Because right now I think that the monies are not, and I think Representative Hillstrom will back me up 100% there, a lot of these people, a lot of these students that are deserving of these funds, and the school districts are not getting the monies.
Any other questions on the panel? No other questions? I just have one comment that you made about don't do the integration on economic academic reasons. Why would you say that if we're supposed to achieve the achievement gap and provide educational opportunities. I didn't quite get that.
The sociological research that I've looked at over the years consistently says, at least within the last 10 or 15, and more vociferously more recently, that you cannot make a definitive connection between integrated schools and higher academic achievement. If that's the only reason that you're spending these millions of dollars, then it may be a misplaced reason. And so my argument is, are there other reasons why we might want to have integration programs? And the data indicates that, yeah, there are long-term benefits to programs like this, including the opportunity for kids who are otherwise racially isolated to network and access economic opportunities that they might not otherwise have.
Okay. I got what you said, but I'm still kind of puzzled about, you know, the academic reasons why we wouldn't do this. Integrating kids, especially on the north side of Minneapolis, where the dropout rates close to 40% with African Americans, the academic reasons for not keeping teachers is overwhelmed. So I have a little problem with that. And the other question, I guess, is the intent. We have been reading the auditor's report, and the intent, because at the end of the day, we want to pull something together to really identify with some solid guidelines for some of the districts that are using the resources. And so at the end of the day, I'm looking for some capacities that we can put back into perspective why these resources were put in the first place. Do you have any statements or any data that shows that this should be an ongoing initiative? Because in some of your statements, you said that it should be an ongoing integration funding. But then I'm hearing that other steps need to be put in place so we can either identify if this is something we want to use as a tool or not. So, you know, because the auditor report really describes some of the issues that are happening, such as computers and other issues that districts are using the funds for. So, again, we're trying to pull something together that it's really going to be substantial so the Board of Education can review and be on top of these issues.
I could make a couple of kind of process suggestions. I think it would be helpful to have a group, maybe this working group or a group of educators, I don't know, some group, sit down, take a look at the rule, take a look at the purpose section, and say, okay, given what's here and given what we've done, what are some definitive criteria by which we might evaluate the success of a particular program? For instance, and give you a for instance, if you want to improve the cultural competence of your teaching staff, there are cultural competence inventories that you can give staff, anybody, to determine how accepting and culturally competent they are of diverse students. You can do interventions for staff, to do staff training, to make them, to give them the skills to be more accommodating, accepting, and supportive of kids from different backgrounds. And you can measure that at the end of your training to see if you've had any success. So if you want to be more prescriptive about this, I think it would be useful to say, okay, these are the purposes that we want, the specific purposes that we want this money used for. We want you to be able to identify what the outcomes are and what the criteria are by which we're going to judge whether you have achieved success, and then we'll decide each year whether we're going to fund you again. I mean, if you want to be that prescriptive, I think there is a way to do that. There are advantages and disadvantages of being that prescriptive. You get more accountability, but you get less flexibility.
Representative Mariani.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Alvarado, so there are tools that exist that could potentially be used to create a way for us to evaluate our roles, one of our roles stated goals or premises of increasing cultural competence for both for students, but obviously for staff as well. And I get that may get in the way of, you know, the flexibility value, but on the other hand, for me, it provides me hopefully, you know, a good objective, consistent way to justify my role as someone who determines where public dollars ought to go and how they should be spent in the state of Minnesota. And I was listening to Bud's list. I'm sorry, Representative Heigerkin's list. It's a great list, and I abut West St. Paul, so I know about some of those programs. But, you know, objectively for me, it's like, well, it's a great list, but, you know, that's not really, you know, it sounds great, but it's not an evaluative. It doesn't give me an evaluative sense of its worth relative to anything else that we do in terms of investing in our schools. And so I think that, I think that that's something we ought to explore. And I understand it's tricky. This is kind of new ground. Let me ask you this. How does this rule, in light of that issue, how does this rule compare, if you will, to others in the country?
Nobody else is doing this.
Doing what?
Last time I checked, no other states have anything like this. They have individual choice programs, but they don't have a state-level policy, which is why I get excited when I talk about it, because I think that Minnesota could be on the cutting edge of something here. I'm just sad to see that it didn't work out the way we had hoped because of implementation issues. So when I presented this paper at Oxford to a bunch of education policymakers from around the country, they were amazed. They didn't know we were doing it, and secondly, nobody else was doing it. So it doesn't compare. There's nothing to compare it with. Could I just back up for a second and throw out one more criteria that you might want to use to think about? It was something that escaped me as I was giving you the reasons why we ought to continue programs like this. Another really good argument for spending money in this way is that it gives kids in racially isolated and socioeconomically isolated environments choices that they might not otherwise have. And so if you, I could see that you might want to take a look at giving kids in particular situations of racial isolation or SES isolation greater choices than perhaps kids in other environments would have. And what I'm thinking about when I say that is the Choice is Yours program, which actually does do that sort of a thing. And there are many ways that you can judge the effectiveness of a choice program, and I did detail those on pages 26 and 27 of that paper that I wrote. A lot of it has to do with really talking about and talking with the students and the parents in those programs to see whether or not they're satisfied with the program, to see whether they feel like they have greater choices, to see whether they feel like the receiving institutions are accommodating and effective. So there are a number of evaluative criteria that you could use if the purpose was to give greater choice to kids in isolated situations. So I think is a perfectly laudable goal and totally consistent with integration efforts.
Well, thank you, Cindy LaFontaine.
Lavarado,
excuse me. We appreciate your presentation, your discussion. We will be taking things in consideration, and thank you again for your time.
You're very welcome.
Thank
if I can
you.
Help you any further, let me know, please.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to welcome Professor Myron Orfield. We asked Myron to comment on the recent Supreme Court decision case involving the Seattle School District. Myron is a full-time assistant professor and is now Professor Orfield has a has taught at the University of Minnesota since 1991. Although many of us know him from the time that he served here in the House, and welcome back home, I am happy to welcome him back today. Myron, thank you so much for coming, and we hope that we'll get a lot out of your presentation. I know we will. You've done this in the past also to the Senate with some of the discussion that has been happening, and I certainly look forward to some more of the presentation and discussions that we are going to receive today. So thank you and welcome. I'll hand it over to you.
And thank you.
If you would just say your name for the record. And
my name is Myron Orfield. I'm an associate professor of law at the University of Minnesota Law School and the director of the Institute on Race and Poverty. I want to talk today about segregation in the metropolitan area of the Twin Cities, the seven-county metropolitan area, the Supreme Court's recent decision in the Parents Involved case, the desegregation rule in Minnesota, and my understanding of its evolution, and kind of outline some of the reforms that the legislature could undertake if it wished to have more integrated schools in the state. I think it's really important when we think about school desegregation and the basis for action in Minnesota that we think not only about what is permitted by the Federal Equal Protection Clause, but also what is mandated by the Minnesota Constitution, both its Equal Protection Clause and its Education Clause. The federal government never recognized, there is no federal right to education. The Supreme Court in San Antonio versus Rodriguez said that. But in Minnesota, in Steen versus State, the state of Minnesota Supreme Court recognized a fundamental right to education, one of 29 Supreme Courts in the United States that has recognized a fundamental right to education. That right to education, recognized by the Minnesota Supreme Court in Skeen, preceded the rule that was promulgated. So the desegregation rule that was promulgated in 2000, and it was brought into effect in 2000, I believe was based on a very conservative reading of what the federal government would prohibit. So I think in Minnesota we made the decision in 2000 to be much more conservative than the Supreme Court would have permitted. We didn't think about what was mandated by the Equal Protection Clause of the state of Minnesota, which is a much broader tool. Minnesota has historically been a state that has been committed to equality of racial opportunity. Minnesota is one of the first states to pass a fair housing law in the legislature. Minneapolis was one of the first cities to pass a fair housing ordinance. Minnesota, the Department of Education, one of the reasons that it's unique, this rule is relatively unique, although it's not unique, so Iowa desegregates under a state desegregation rule. Many of the states of the border states south do. But Minnesota took an unusually proactive approach to this in the early 70s in response to federal litigation in Minneapolis. So in many ways, what happened in the year 2000 was really striking. It was a really striking reversal of a long-term historical trend in Minnesota to be proactive about these issues. I want to talk a little bit, too, about the harms of segregation and the benefits of integration, and I'll go into this in more detail in my testimony. One of the interesting things about thinking about the benefits and harms of segregation is to look at the briefs that were filed in the Seattle case. And in the Seattle case, there were many social science briefs filed by both parties. My reading of both of those briefs, even the most conservative critics of the effects of integration believed that integration had a significant effect on academic achievement. Even the critics believe that racial and social integration had an effect on achievement. One of the things that was more striking in the agreement is that kids that go to racially and socially integrated schools have a far greater chance of finishing high school, of going to college, and of having middle income earnings. And so one of the times when we think about the effects of racial and social segregation, we often concentrate on the narrow findings in terms of test scores and academic success, and we ignore the broadly accepted findings about graduation rates, college attendance, and middle-income earnings, which are associated with racial and social integration. It's also very important to realize that when we're talking about racial and social integration, we're talking about race and class walking together. In the United States, and in this metropolitan region, if you're white and poor, three-quarters of poor white children go to majority middle-income schools. If you are black and Latino in this region and poor, three-quarters of poor black and Latino children go to majority poor schools. And this makes a huge difference. Professor Alvarado talked about the effects trying to predict the success of kids. And it is true, I agree with her in saying that your parents are a very powerful predictor of your potential for academic success and achievement, probably more important than any other factor. But after that, the peer group that a kid goes to school with is the most powerful and significant predictor of finishing high school, of going to college, and getting beyond. Let me go into some of the facts of what's happening in the metropolitan area, talk about some of the lost opportunities that have occurred in the last decade, some of the really tragic consequences of the lack of action in terms of children's lives, in terms of communities, in terms of the metropolitan area. In 1992, in the metropolitan area, there were only nine non-white segregated schools, about 2% of all schools in the metropolitan area. It was one of the it was the last major region of the country to have very powerfully integrated social and racially integrated schools. By 2002, the number of non-white segregated schools had jumped to 109, nearly 20% of all schools. The share of students of color attending non-white segregated schools increased more than fivefold, from 9% in 1992 to 46% in 2002. The number of students of color attending non-white segregated schools in the Twin Cities area skyrocketed from 2,832 in 1992 to 29,000 in 2002. The share of black students in non-white segregated schools more than tripled, from 14 to 50% during this time period. This meant that 14,560 black elementary students attended segregated schools in 2002. And these numbers are rapidly increasing. The share of Latinos and Asian students attending non-white segregated schools increased even more dramatically, from 3 to 39%, and that trend has grown much faster since this period, since the 2002. In 1992, the school poverty rate faced by the typical non-white elementary school students increased from 40 to 44%, while the rate by the typical white student, poor student, decreased from 14 to 13%. The share of non-white students attending non-white segregated schools in the central cities jumped from 12 to 75% during this period. I'm going to show some maps, and one of the things that I want to talk about is how these patterns are occurring, deepening in the central cities. I don't know if you can see these very well. They're also available on the website of the IRP. I'll try to talk about them as descriptively as I can. But segregation is increasing, it's deepening profoundly in the central cities. Many of the older and inner-ring suburbs are feeling the effects of segregation. These effects are caused by discrimination in the housing market, steering, residential discrimination, buying, selling, and renting, mortgage lending discrimination, which is persistent, school boundary decisions, which are under the oversight of the Department of Education, have almost always increased racial and social segregation in the places where these have occurred. This doesn't necessarily have to be the case. In many parts of the country, the supervision of these kinds of decisions has become more proactive in places like the border state south and Chattanooga, Tennessee, Raleigh, North Carolina. Many school districts have become more proactive. This is a map that shows the percentage of black and Latino students by elementary school in 2005 and 2006. You can see the red dots in the middle of Minneapolis and St. Paul are schools that are more than 69% black and Latino together. The schools that are orange are between 50 and 69%, light orange 24 to 50%, and it goes down the line. You can see that many of the central city schools are in the highest category and the second highest category. You can see that the first tier suburbs, East Bloomington, parts of Burnsville, are right behind. This is the percentage of students on free and reduced lunch, and it illustrates the fact that black and Latino poor children are overwhelmingly likely to go to high poverty schools. White poor children are not nearly so likely. So white poor children have, because of the lack of housing discrimination, because of steering, residential discrimination, mortgage lending, have much more choice to go to schools that are lower poverty. I'm going to talk a little bit about Minneapolis. I'm going to talk about several of the specific districts and the patterns of segregation that are occurring in those districts, and talk about how a more proactive approach might lessen some of these trends. This is the Minneapolis school system. These are the elementary schools of Minneapolis in 1999 to 2000. The size of the circle is the size of the elementary school. The color charts are the race of the students that are attending those schools. So the portion of those schools that are red are black, yellow Latino, white is blue, orange is Asian Pacific Islander, and green is American Indian. One of the things that you'll see is from 1999 to the present is that the schools in the central part of Minneapolis are going to become majority Latino and black. The white students will disappear largely from those schools. On the southwestern side of the city, the schools will become much whiter. On the north side of the city, the schools will become increasingly black during this period. So this is 99 to 2000, 2000 to 2001, 2001 to 2002, 2002 to 2003, 2003 to 2004, 2004 to 2005, 2005 to 2006. Now, one of the things that happened in Minneapolis during this period of dramatic increases in segregation in the city was a huge loss of students to the, in the central city school system, moving from about 50-some thousand students to the low 30s. A catastrophic loss of school enrollment often accompanies racial hyper-segregation. This has happened in many large school districts before as they've achieved these levels of segregation. A large part of this loss was kids moving out of the district. Another part was charter schools. And charter schools have grown exponentially during this period, or very rapidly, if not exponentially. They are more segregated than the public schools, performing worse for kids of color, are specifically exempted from the state's desegregation rules. So they have a green light to be as segregated as they want. Many market themselves as ethnocentric schools. The central cities in both cities are now forced to compete for enrollment with charter schools that are single race or nearly single race, that are exploding in population, marketing themselves to kids that have had probably had a very tough experience with the increasingly segregated schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul. This is race. Now let's take a look at class during this period. Free lunch eligibility. This is the same map showing the percentage of poor kids. And as you see, the schools become majority Latino in Minneapolis and the core city, and majority black, or mostly black and Asian on the north side. You'll see that the schools also become poorer, and the middle-class kids that remain in those systems are disappearing. This is 99 to 2000, 2000 to 2001, 2001 to 2002, 2002 to 2003, 2003 to 2004, 2004 to 2005. And you see in Minneapolis, which is during most of this period, it's been the whitest or the second whitest of the 25 largest regions, a pattern of hyper-segregation that is occurring, intense racial and social segregation that never happened in this metropolitan area before, and no one probably would have imagined could have happened in the early 90s. Maps of St. Paul that show similar but less dramatic patterns in St. Paul, but increasing. You have schools in the far southwestern part of St. Paul that are white, and in St. Anthony Park that are becoming whiter. Schools in the core cities are becoming large, heavier share of black Latinos and Asian kids, and poor. St. Paul is on the verge of thinking about not using race anymore as an assignment tool in assigning kids to schools. And one of the reasons, at least pointed out by the Minneapolis Star Tribune in an article by Jim Walsh about within the last 3 or 4 months, is intense competition by charter schools in a single-race environment. So St. Paul is, at least according to the newspapers, thinking about abandoning race as a tool to integrate schools so that they can compete for enrollment with the charter schools that are growing rapidly. I'm going to talk a little bit about the older suburbs. This is the maps of St. Paul. I'd be happy to talk about these in greater detail in questions. I want to get ahead to talk about some of the suburban schools so that we can see how these patterns play themselves out in the older suburbs. Computer's slow. I apologize for that. This is a map of the Osseo School District and the Robbinsdale School District. And I'm going to show you the same kind of map over the same period of racial and social change between 95 and 2005, and how race and class are connected in these districts just like they are in the Central City District. Now, in the United States and in this metropolitan area, a majority or a near majority of black households and Latino households are in the suburbs. If you look at black married families with children and Latino married families with children, about 70% live in the suburbs, and that trend is increasing. As black and Latino families move to the suburbs, national evidence suggests that they have much fewer choices than whites of similar income. Steering by real estate agents throughout the country is often steers black and Latino households to integrated schools in the suburbs and steers whites away from those same schools, steers whites moving to suburban locations to predominantly white schools. Discrimination in the buying and selling and renting. When black and Latino families are buying in white neighborhoods, they systematically encounter barriers to purchase that whites of similar income don't have. Mortgage lending discrimination. The Institute for Race and Poverty that I'm working at shows, and I'm not going to talk about this today, a long history of mortgage lending discrimination. Black and Latino households just get less credit, and they're much more likely to be denied conventional credit than whites with similar background and education, much more likely to be subject to extreme appeals for subprime and even predatory lending. These things fit together. Housing discrimination takes away from black and Latino households conservatively a third of the choices that they have, and some scholars estimate as many as two-thirds. Another thing that's happening in these particular places are boundary decisions that school districts are making, and these are highly charged things. It's very, very hard for school districts to encounter and deal with the animosity that are affected when boundary decisions are being made. Often you have a highly mobilized, affluent part of the district that wants boundaries keeping the affluent kids together. On the other side of the district are less mobilized, less informed, less politically strong minority households that have a hard time participating, knowing that these decisions are being made or participating. With a lack of oversight, when there's a lack of oversight in these boundary decisions, it's very hard for school districts facing this sort of unequal power to make decisions that are integrative. In fact, in the decisions that I've looked at in the metropolitan area, almost all of the boundary decisions that have been made in the metropolitan area have intensified racial and social segregation. Yep.
Excuse me, Representative Orfield.
Yeah.
We have a question from Representative Hillstrom.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Orfield,
yep.
It actually is a comment about it. When the Osseo School District was looking at closing schools, there was a very racially isolated school that they were looking at. There were five schools on the list. And one of the parent groups that attempted to get very involved, but they had the parent meeting at the school the day the school board was making the decision. They didn't even go to the location where the decision was actually being made because it was being held in Maple Grove.
Yeah.
They were not mobile. They didn't have transportation. You know, and so I just wanted to comment that that is exactly what happened when, and that's a real example. What happened when, and that's a real example. When the legislature had gone out to the school, had a hearing when they were talking about closing it, and then when the actual vote came, the parents were meeting in the school when the school board was voting on the school closure.
This is it's a very, very difficult thing for districts on their own to make pro-integrative decisions. And I'm going to talk about Eden Prairie in a minute, who has been trying to implement those decisions or not. But in Osseo, I've been trying to reconstruct the history of the boundary decisions in Osseo, and for 6 months I've been trying to get the records of how the decisions were made, and I've had no success in that. So it is it's a difficult thing even to reconstruct in retrospect. Let me show you the maps that show what's happened in Osseo. This is 95 to 96, and these are the same race and class maps. 95, 96, 96, 97, 97, 98, 98, 99, 1999, 2000, 2001, and you can see these patterns from east to west are strikingly similar to the patterns that occurred in Minneapolis in the 1970s and St. Paul in the 1980s and beyond. You can see the district becoming very divided, both the Robbinsdale district and particularly the Osseo district, in terms of these decisions. And some of these decisions were about patterns of housing settlement and location, the neighborhoods themselves becoming more segregated. Some of these decisions were influenced by boundaries. The Supreme Court said in Keyes versus Metropolitan Center District is that school and housing decisions are reciprocal, have reciprocal effects. When you make decisions in terms of school boundaries, it affects the housing market. When you make decisions in terms of the housing market, it affects the schools. They're not isolated. They don't operate in isolation. They strongly affect each other. And you can see this pattern in Osseo and Robbinsdale. Here's the free lunch. And again, you see the schools that are becoming majority black and Latino and Asian are also becoming majority poor. A lot of people think that these patterns of resegregation stop neatly at the central city borders, and nothing could be further from the truth. For the last two decades in American life, maybe three, the largest resegregation that has occurred in the United States has been in older suburbs of the United States. People, places like Prince George's County in Washington and the suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia. These patterns are now being deeply rooted in our older suburban communities, and you can see how poor some of these elementary schools are becoming. Now, I don't know the details of the Osseo boundary decisions, but I do know that they were reported in the paper of being controversial in the Minneapolis Star Tribune in the mid-90s. There were announcements in the paper that there would be no east to west boundaries, which sound very reminiscent of the kinds of boundary decisions that were made in Minneapolis in the late 60s and early 70s. Minneapolis was later found to have violated the Federal Equal Protection Clause in the Booker versus Special School District No. 1 case. Let's take a look at the southern suburbs and what's going on in the southern suburbs. You can see Richfield and Bloomington from east to west, and the patterns of the same patterns occurring from 96 to 97, 97, 98, 98, 99, 99, 2000, 2000 to 2001, 2001 to 2002. Now, in 2001, the Bloomington School District made middle school boundary decisions and was reboundering their middle schools. And there was a difference of opinion in terms of they had several plans that they noticed for public comment, some of which were more racially integrated than the others. There were four or five options. There were people on both sides of the decision, particularly families on the east side of Bloomington testified in favor and advocated for the more integrated position. The school board, in a decision that's been hard for me to figure out exactly what happened, again, difficult, picked the most segregated alternative. And this is, again, very hard for local school districts to make pro-integrative decisions when they are under the gun to think about this. Now, cumulatively, this has big effects on kids' lives, kids that aren't represented in those kinds of decisions, kids that are going to the schools that are going to be overwhelmingly poor and more isolated. You can see that many of the first-ring suburbs are on the path toward becoming majority poor and Latino and high poverty. These are things that state public policy could have a very big effect on dealing with. You can see the older suburban schools, particularly Valley View on the east side of Bloomington, becoming more separated. Now, these decisions are not only going to have very deep harms to children, but they're going to have harms to those communities. When schools become racially identified and overwhelmingly poor, there's very strong evidence that racial steering increases, so that whites are more likely to be directed away from those neighborhoods over time, and that black and Latino families more directed toward those. School composition, recent studies by the National Fair Housing Center showed that school composition was a key element in steering, so that once schools become racially identifiable, they become harder and harder to keep integrated over time. When the schools become poor, housing markets will change in those neighborhoods. It'll be harder and harder to attract middle-class families and reinvestment to those areas. Let's take a look at test scores. Test scores are really strongly coherent with the percentage of poor kids in schools. They're not so correlated with race, but they're really strongly connected with poor kids. So when schools become poorer, the test scores are really almost locked at the hip, just like just to poverty. So you can see This is the percentage of students with proficient scores in the reading portion of the MCA school assessment test, and you can see that the low scores really correlate strongly with the high poverty schools in both the cities and the older suburbs. This is often something that people look at when they're buying houses. They look at the test scores in the paper that are there. This is the Osseo School District, and you can see that the kids in the inner suburbs, the schools that are much higher poverty, and the poverty often coupled to racial segregation, you can see the highest score, the highest percentage of the kids that do not meet standards or partially meet standards. And you can see these things, these patterns growing in the Osseo School, in the Robbinsdale School District as well. Math and science both together, very similar. In Richfield and East Bloomington, you can see these test scores. As the poverty percentage rises, the test scores decline. In Minneapolis, the segregated schools are the lowest scoring. And this becomes a really difficult and problematic thing. As schools become poorer and poorer, the test scores are often declining because of the demographics, and they're subject to higher and higher needs to make progress. So the demographics, in some ways, are driving in the opposite direction of the requirements, high penalty requirements that are associated with these tests. As the schools become poorer, they do worse, and they're more likely to become penalized. This is happening in the older suburbs, too. The schools that are growing at the outer edge of the region, that are more affluent, are doing better and are not subject to these rules. This is a map that shows that the scores in Minneapolis, and again, you can see in Lake Harriet School, the school that is becoming all white in the southwest part of the city, it has one of the highest set of test scores in the entire state. It's 2 or 3 miles away from one of the lowest scoring schools in the state, in the same district, with the same administration, the same curriculum, the same bureaucracy, the same basic issues in a school that is largely middle class and white, and high income is knocking the top off the test scores. A few miles away, the segregated poor schools are chasing the bottom. This is a map that shows the charter schools, which are proliferating. I'm going to talk about charter schools and how they're affecting racial segregation. This is a map that, the diamonds on this map are public schools. And you can see that as poverty goes up, test scores go down. And you can see a pretty straight line relationship with that. So you can see the places that have the lowest poverty have the highest test scores. Now, the diamonds are the charter schools, and they're almost all under the line of the public schools. So pound for pound, a charter school that has a certain level of poverty does worse than a public school. They both, high poverty schools both do badly on test scores. But charter schools carrying the same weight of poverty as public schools do worse. And that's saying a lot, because the public schools are not doing very well in the segregated environment. There's a few charter schools that are above that line, but the majority are below. Now, charters are exploding in enrollment. They are growing very fast and educating a large share of kids. And they often charter schools market themselves saying that they're going to do better for kids that have had a really terrible experience in the public schools. And they promise them that they're going to make a big difference in their lives. But the data show that they're not. The data show that they're doing worse, and they're having very powerful effects on the system of public education and financing of the schools in the central city. This is math proficiency, and you can see the diamonds, the red diamonds are the charters, the blue diamonds are the public schools, and you can see that by and large the charter schools are underperforming. Let me see if I can get to the next slide. I'm freezing up here. Well, wish I could show you some more slides here. What I would show you in these slides, if I could show you more, is that you would see the charter schools, many of them are single race, all black, all Latino. Sometimes the all-black and all-Latino charter schools are next to almost all-white charter schools in St. Paul particularly, that are very close by them, in a pattern that's even more dramatic than the public schools. As you can imagine, the all-white charter schools are doing reasonably well on the test scores. They have some of those diamonds that are above the curve, but the poor ones and the ones that are specifically African-American Latino are some of the lowest scoring schools in the state. About half of the charter schools reported test data this last year. and all the public schools did that I'm aware of, about half of the charter schools reported data. Why is that? It's a good question. I don't know all the answers to that. I think that part of it is the size of the charter schools. If they're of a certain size, they don't have to report data. How is the data reported? Who does that? It's a very complicated thing. It's hard to judge. But by the charter schools that are reporting, the only half that are reporting, they are lower. And you can here's some basic skills tests. Here's a percentage of 10th grade kids, and this is the metropolitan area. You can see that the poorest schools in Minneapolis, the most racially segregated ones, the 10th graders are doing the worst. You can see the older suburbs, they're right behind. You can see the dropout rates. And this is something that is very strongly connected to racial and social segregation dropout rates. The social science research shows pretty conclusively that high poverty schools enhance dropout rates. So that kids, when they're going to all poor schools, are much more likely to drop out of school than they are in mixed-income schools. And this is true in the all-white poor schools of Appalachia. It's true in the all-black poor schools of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And all poor schools increase dropout rates. And social scientists think that kids' dropout rates increase from 2- and 4-fold from being in all poor schools and middle-income schools. And middle-income schools don't equalize dropout rates. They don't make them equal, but they dramatically reduce the probability that poor kids are going to drop out of school. And this is a very big Rubicon in people's lives, whether you finish or not. Going to college is strongly associated with the poverty rate in your school. And there are very few kids that emerge from these poor segregated schools to college. Kids are not only, when kids go to college, when they apply to college, they're not only rated on their test scores and their academic achievements, but they're also rated on what high school that they went to. Guidance counselors in middle-income schools have much stronger relationships with college officials, and poor kids don't benefit by these kinds of social networks and connections. Very few kids get their first job based on their resume. It's very much likely based on their social relationships and connections. Schools aren't just books and instruction and money. They're also social networks and access to opportunity. And kids that go to really poor segregated schools just don't have those networks. And they're growing. And you can see this in dropout rates and completion rates across the map. They're very much lower in the high poverty schools in the cities and the suburbs. Crime in very poor segregated schools is higher. And this is another thing that is very disruptive to kids. And when poverty is concentrated, this is one of the outcomes. It's one of the things that disrupts their ability. And it's part of segregation. It's part of the social separation that's occurring in metropolitan areas. Kids' prison population in many studies in Texas and Florida is related to segregated schools. They looked at some of the factors that try to predict whether people are going to end up in prison in the future. And they looked at family composition and income and structure and neighborhoods. And they found that the racial and social composition, particularly the social composition in high schools, is one of the more powerful predictors that children were going to end up in the system of incarceration. If you look at Minnesota, there's a 20-to-1 disparity by race in the prisons. Blacks and Latinos are overrepresented 20-fold in the Minnesota prisons. And if you look back at the places these kids went to high school, it's much more likely to be in one of these racially and socially isolated high schools. Charter schools, here I have some of the demographics, and you can see these are the charter schools in the Twin Cities. There it goes. These are the charter schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And you can see the charter schools, there's not too many charter schools, or not any charter schools in southwest Minneapolis where the schools are becoming increasingly white and affluent. The charter schools are largely confined to the boundaries of the cities where the school, where the public schools are segregated. And so the charter schools are growing up in the same neighborhoods where the public schools are segregated. Now these are the charter schools, you can see all the single race charter schools that are there. We don't have, Minneapolis is an Afrocentric academy. I understand there may be an effort to have more race-specific schools, but you can see several in St. Paul and several in Minneapolis that are race-specific. You can see in St. Paul, all black charter schools next to majority white charter schools within almost the same neighborhood. Each of these charter schools is a separate school district for purposes of the desegregation rules, so they're completely immune from any rules, whatever few rules there are that apply to the public schools. And when they're growing and competing for enrollment in these poor neighborhoods, it's driving the public schools to offer more segregated alternatives. This is the race of the metropolitan area, and you can see this is the race of kids in the charter schools. 39% of the kids in charter schools are black, 9% are Latino, 14% are Asian, 34% are white, and the percentage of black and Latino kids going to these schools is growing up. These are racially isolated, racially segregated charter schools in the metropolitan area, and you can see that a large share of them in the two central cities that meet that definition, I think, troubling. These are charter schools that were closed for financial misappropriation. So as these charter schools are growing in some of the poorest neighborhoods of the city, educating some of the most vulnerable kids, there's a significant chance that these schools are going to, the administrators of these schools are going to be misappropriating funds. You can see these schools, these are the ones who just reported in the Star Tribune. They're subject to much less rules and oversight than the public schools are. There's much more freedom. And it's a very problematic thing in the sense that the children that are there are the least enfranchised, least well represented kids in the metropolitan area. They're from some of the poorest homes, with some of the most stressed out parents, with some of the least ability to see what's happening. Increasingly, the poorest of the poor kids, most vulnerable kids, are in these schools, and these are schools that are likely to have some significant mismanagement. You can see these are just reports from the papers. One of the things that we've been doing as a metropolitan area is concentrating low-income housing in the poorest parts of the cities and the older suburbs. This is a map that shows Minneapolis and the low-income housing tax credit since 1985. And you can see overwhelmingly the low-income family units that were constructed during this period were located in some of the poorest and most segregated school attendance areas. Many federal court cases have taken note of the fact that building all of the low-income family housing in poor segregated neighborhoods raises questions under the Federal Fair Housing Act. In lawsuits in Chicago and in other parts of the country, civil rights lawyers have challenged the building of a disproportionate share of affordable housing in poor neighborhoods. You can see this on a metropolitan basis, too. From 1970 till 82, the Twin Cities metropolitan area operated one of the most progressive suburban affordable housing programs in the United States. From 1970 till 82, 11,000 units of family housing were built at the developing suburban ring of the Twin Cities. And of those units built at the developing edge of the region, half were held by black and Latino households. So from 1970 till 82, the region operated one of the most far-sighted and pro-integrative housing programs in the country. And it probably forestalled racial and social segregation in the cities and the older suburbs for a decade. When that was stopped, we caught up pretty quickly with the rest of the country in these trends. We're still not as segregated as the rest of the country, but going that way. This is a map that shows the choice is yours. In 1995, the state of Minnesota was sued by the NAACP and low-income minority plaintiffs alleging that segregated schools violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Minnesota Constitution. Not the federal constitution, but the Minnesota Constitution. And the state of Minnesota settled with the plaintiffs. They decided to settle. Nine suburban districts voluntarily agreed to accept kids. And it's interesting that when the rule was promulgated, so this was in the middle of this lawsuit, that there was no account taken for the Minnesota Constitution in this rule. It was based on a really restrictive reading of the federal constitution. In fact, more restrictive probably than the federal courts have decided in the Seattle case. And I'll get to that in a minute. But at the same time the rule was being promulgated, we had a very active lawsuit under the Minnesota Constitution. And the state constitution, in drafting this rule, after Skeen had been decided, which decided that education was a fundamental right, took no account of this. Now, in this period, the settlement allowed for about 2,000 kids to leave the poorest and most segregated neighborhoods of Minneapolis and attend schools that were less than 50% of the kids in poverty. And it allowed kids to take with them a significant portion of compensatory aid to the school districts that were participating. So that when a school district would admit one of these very low-income poor kids, it would take along with them about $2,300 of extra compensatory aid above and beyond what the school districts were spending. That's my understanding of it. Now, the kids on average were leaving schools that were spending $13,000 or $14,000 a pupil and moving to schools that were spending about $8,500 per pupil, taking with them their compensatory aid. So kids were taking some part of that significant money, and the suburban districts admitted about 2,000 kids. And the map shows in Minneapolis where the kids came from and where they were going. The dark areas of the city are where the kids came from, and the dots are the school districts they attended. Some of these kids attended very affluent school districts. Some went to inner-ring suburban districts that were already in themselves in the process of resegregation. So some of it was implemented in a way that provided kids access to very high opportunity school districts, some not so high. This is a map that showed during this period that almost every kid that left the central cities was more than replaced by the policy of building low-income housing in the same neighborhood. So that while the state was providing opportunity with one hand, they were reinforcing the patterns of segregation with the other. This is a broad trends in the U.S. in terms of integration. In the United States, kids became more integrated every year from the middle 60s all the way up till about 1975 or 76. So racial integration increased. It peaked for about 12 years. Kids were going to integrated schools for about 12 years. In the early 90s, as federal court orders started to be pulled apart, the schools in the United States became more segregated. Last year, the schools in the United States became more racially and socially segregated than they were in 1968. Within about 18 months, the schools in the United States will become more racially and socially segregated than they were in 1964. So there's been quite a reverse in this. In the South, the situation is a little bit more positive. In the South, where the school districts were countywide, when they adopted integration plans, they were metropolitan in scale, largely. Places like Louisville and Raleigh and Nashville and Knoxville and Chattanooga. The schools were really totally segregated in the 1950s, you can see this, and they became much more integrated all during this period. The South, which is much more racially diverse than the North is, because they had broader boundaries, became more integrated and stayed more integrated. It's still starting to trail off, but you can see that there's a pattern, particularly in the border state South, of longer-term integration. One of the things that happens in the United States is that without thinking about integration, when people just stop thinking about this and allow segregation to occur, there's a pattern of resegregation that occurs, neighborhood after neighborhood after neighborhood. In the United States, in general, when a neighborhood becomes about 30% black or Latino, it's more likely to become all black or Latino than remain integrated. And you can see this is a map that shows this trend in the United States. This is a map that shows the 16 metropolitan areas that had metropolitan plans for integration, places like Louisville and Raleigh and Nashville and Knoxville. They remained integrated over the long period of time. They really, in many ways, broke the back of resegregation. So the schools that were in metropolitan plans that had integrated schools in the 1970s and 80s, they still remained integrated in the 90s and 2000s. So places that operate on a metropolitan scale, really, neighborhoods became much more racially and socially integrated than regions did. Places like Bloomington would have stayed much more integrated. Places like Osseo and Brooklyn Center, had they had plans like Louisville and Raleigh and Knoxville, Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park, all those places would have been much more stably integrated if they had thought about this. So in this sense, thinking about having more integrated schools is not only really important for kids' opportunity, it's really important for maintaining the stability of neighborhoods. And 15 or 20 places around the country have shown pretty conclusively that it has these effects. It not only helps kids, but helps neighborhoods. This is a map that shows the Apple Valley School District, and this goes to show you what can happen when there's really no oversight about these rules. You can see this is a map that shows the Cedar Park Elementary School area, and this is the underlying map shows the racial composition of the tract. The green area shows the boundary decisions, and you can and that little brown square. Cedar Park Elementary, that was a trailer park that was largely occupied by Latino kids. And Apple Valley, up until very recently, up until this year, operated, had district boundaries that connected that trailer park to an apartment complex on the other part of the city. So that the kids in that trailer park were bused across more affluent attendance areas to attend school with poorer and more diverse kids in the southern part of the district. You can see the Shannon Park Elementary School has two white areas that are connected on the side of a diverse area. Now, these were boundaries. This is the kind of thing, I think, that can happen when immense pressure is brought to bear on school districts. Now, the state of, as I understand this, and I don't know all the rules, but the state of Minnesota's Department of Education took action about this year and required this district to be fixed, the Cedar Park Elementary School. But these are things that are likely to occur without rules, or at least have occurred in many parts of the country. Eden Prairie is a place that has done, heretofore has done sort of the opposite. They have tried to draw their boundaries to be more integrated. Now, this is one of the few situations when I've seen where a district proactively, that's becoming racially diverse, draws its boundaries to try to be more racially integrated. So you can see there's a pocket of relatively racialized poverty in Eden Prairie there, and it's divided into many school attendance areas. Now, this is that they've been under very, very significant pressure, the school district, to undo this boundary and to do the same thing that Apple Valley did. I read in the newspaper, and I don't know the facts of this, about a week or two ago, that Eden Prairie is going to abandon this policy to try to keep their schools integrated. And I don't know why. I think this would be something that might be in the subject of the school district. I know it's been controversial, and this is a hard thing unilaterally for school districts to do. And this is one of the things that a good, strong desegregation rule can do. This is one of the benefits. It can insulate these local decision makers from the really intense pressure that is put on them by highly activated parents to make these decisions, like in the Apple Valley School District, and can help school districts like Eden Prairie, if they want to be more proactive in the drawing of their boundaries. It's something that is within your purview. Hopkins made boundary decisions recently, and Hopkins was dealing with a growing diverse population, and Hopkins had to close one elementary school, the Catherine Curran Elementary School. And the Catherine Curran Elementary School was the most diverse in the district. It was about 50% white and 50% non-white. And they were trying, I think the Hopkins School District was trying to think about how to do that and what to do with the children in the most diverse district if they closed one school because of enrollment declines. Several alternatives were floated. And Hopkins initially thought about having some of the kids of color be in schools like the Glen Lake School and the Gatewood Elementary School, but pressure in those schools resulted in a decision where most of the kids went to the schools that were already diverse. And the Hopkins School District, as it thought about these, really struggled with the clarity of the rule about what to do and what they ought to do. There was great pressure from the more affluent parts of the district not to have those kids of color go to those schools. And it was very hard. The school district decided to have most of those low-income kids of color go to the poorer, more diverse schools. And this, over time, will likely result in the same kinds of outcomes that have happened in Central City. So, what can be done about all this? Partly, I think, thinking on a metropolitan level about rules. The legislature gave the State Board of Education in the mid-90s the power to promulgate a metropolitan rule. The legislature acted and gave an appointed roundtable promulgated a metropolitan rule. It was never implemented. The rule that finally resulted was one that was very convoluted, very complex, very hard to understand. In many ways, more conservative, even than, and more narrow in terms of the way that resolution could be resolved than the Supreme Court's recent ruling. The Supreme Court, for example, in the Seattle case, Justice Kennedy, writing in the concurrence, said that boundaries could be used proactively. The Supreme Court very clearly said that what Eden Prairie was doing was not only okay, but it was a good thing, and that it would not subject to a rule like that to strict scrutiny. There's been no guidance or support, as far as I can tell, to that kind of decision that Eden Prairie is making. The Supreme Court also said that race could be used in making assignments. It had to be used among other factors, like the Grutter decision, like the education decision. So the Supreme Court, at least Justice Kennedy's concurrence, suggests that race could be used. Many school districts, looking at the state rule and the guidance, have decided they couldn't use race. Capitol Hill Elementary School was using race to assign kids to the magnet program. Because of the state rule and because of how conservatively promulgated the rule, they stopped doing that. They were afraid. There was no reinforcement. And the magnet school in St. Paul's become whiter. In Lake Harriet School in southwest part of Minneapolis, parents have, a group of parents that had asked the school district to be more integrated. The school district said that it was barred from taking action like that because of the rules that were promulgated. So there's been a chilling effect in this, and the legislature could have an impact. I think legislatures decide whether they want to use the full strength of the Equal Protection Clause of the Minnesota Constitution, or they want to move to an even more narrow interpretation of the Equal Protection Clause than the federal courts do. I think Minneapolis and the metropolitan area since the early 2000 has implemented a racially even more narrow approach than the federal courts have allowed. Minnesota historically has been a civil rights state. As one of the states that was the first to pass their housing acts, first to pass civil rights acts, it's always it's been on the cutting edge of this. But Minneapolis was the last major city in the country that had integrated schools. They were one of the last major cities in the country that maintained integrated schools well into the 1990s, decade after the bigger, larger cities had gone. Now it's looking a lot more like the older, larger cities of the country. And it has effects not only on children, but on neighborhoods. And taking action on this could not only help children, but also help the stability of neighborhoods over the long period of time. And you can see, as individual districts struggle with these highly charged boundary decisions with no guidance, it's very, very hard for them to make a pro-integrative choice. You can see this in Hopkins, you can see this in Apple Valley, you can see this in Bloomington, you can see this in Osseo, you can see this in Minneapolis, you can see this in St. Paul. Almost every racially diverse district has had a really hard time all by itself doing this, and the same kinds of patterns occur. So a clear rule, a rule that uses the power of the Minnesota Constitution could make a big difference. I talked a little bit in this case about what the Supreme Court allows for. I talked about the Minnesota Constitution, and I talked about the federal Constitution. Now, one of the things about the last school desegregation rule is I think it took a very conservative view of what constitutes a boundary violation. If you read the Supreme Court's decision in Keyes versus Metropolitan School District, there are several things that suggest a federal equal protection violation. I think that the Supreme Court in the Keyes decision, under federal law, says the structure of school attendance zones and feeder schools, the location of school construction, the use of mobile classrooms, student transfer policies, the transportation of students, the assignments to faculty and staff, the kinds of things that are often happening on a district-by-district basis. These decisions that not only hurt kids, but hurt neighborhoods. I think that thinking about the Keyes decision more clearly, thinking about the Minnesota Constitution more clearly, thinking about having an educational financing system that supports a pro-integrative system. I haven't talked as much as I could about the school funding, and this is, I'm sure, a principal subject of concern. But one of the patterns that you see in the funding system as a whole is it has a tendency to reward really segregated schools and not provide the kinds of financial incentives to encourage integrated schools. And the schools, the really hyper-segregated schools of Minneapolis and St. Paul, funding levels are $14,000 a pupil. This is a system that rewards, it takes a system at the margin, encourages a system that is quasi-segregated to intensify this. It creates financial incentives. The Choice is Yours program is, I think, a model about how funding could encourage integration, about allowing the money to follow kids to more integrated and successful schools, and creating some financial incentives for the receiving districts to do that. Also, in many parts of the country, in New York State, in Louisville, Kentucky, housing programs were connected to school programs. There were benefits to communities that were proactively siting affordable housing in communities of high school opportunities. Some places like Louisville, instead of building all the tax credit units in the poorest and most segregated neighborhoods, trying to encourage areas that had very affluent schools to allow choices, pro-integrative choices. I think these would be really good policies. These were the policies, in large part, that Minnesota followed in the 1970s in being proactive about schools. So I think they are good models.
Myron, also we have a question from Representative Hillstrom.
Sure, thank you. My question is, I think it's really great when you can give incentives, but everyone gets afraid that that means that their schools are going to lose dollars, and at a time when we don't have additional dollars, what are your thoughts about where we might come up with the strategy without damaging the school district? I mean, I would never want to implement a program that would leave Minneapolis less strong school
right.
district, because ultimately that's going to affect my
right.
school district as well.
Well, one of the things I think that it's important to realize is that by not acting and not responding to the growing racial and social segregation that's occurring in the cities and the older suburbs, you are in effect reducing the dollar amounts that are going. Those kids are leaving. You know, Minneapolis has had a catastrophic loss of enrollment, and I think it's partly because the school districts have become so segregated. The older suburbs are going to follow that. So you're going to see, I mean, the wave that's hit Minneapolis is going to be fully engaged in places like Richfield and East Bloomington and the whole core of inner suburbs. So kids, by not acting on this, there's going to be a large loss of students. You know, between 1969 and 89, the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul closed 60-some schools. The first string of suburbs closed 65 schools, and we built 50 at the edge. So in many ways, if you look at the capital programs and the state bonding support, there are dozens and dozens of new schools being built at the edge. And as these patterns are rooting themselves in the older suburbs, they are undermining these older suburbs. So partly, I think, thinking proactively about new funds and how you can not take anything away, but how new funds going forward can be shaped to try to encourage kids to have the most successful educational experience they have. In places like Louisville and Raleigh, many of the older places that became less segregated had big new boosts in enrollment. If you take a look at what's happened in many urban neighborhoods where the schools have been stably integrated, and older suburban neighborhoods, families move into those schools and repopulate them. So I think it's thinking about not taking away anything from people, but going forward, how to encourage less segregated metropolitan areas, to encourage stronger and more stable older suburbs and inner cities. And in some ways, you'll see strong incentives for rebuilding and revitalization that occur. Also, I think sometimes things that are in the short term seem beneficial in the long term. The central cities have competed very hard for the low-income housing tax credits against the newer suburban areas like Scott County and Wright County and many of the places that would like to utilize those credits. In the short term, it has meant more money coming into the central cities, but in the long term, it's created more isolated, segregated neighborhoods and prevented families from having broader residential choices. And I think that making sure that kids have choices not only gives kids choices, but it gives breathing room to older places to renew themselves. I don't know if that does.
Representative Grady.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Orfield, or Representative Orfield, it's wonderful to have you back and realize how much we miss you here to hear all your great information and challenges and everything like that. It sounds to me like you're recommending not only looking at the legislative auditor's report, but going far beyond that, and I appreciate that kind of input. I would ask you, too, to critique the auditor's report, and then I want to know, would you recommend including charter schools in the DSEG rule? What do you think of the voluntary integration schools? Have they made an impact in terms of your evaluation? And then, are there other states that, if I can remember all these questions, are there other states that have done something in their rule with oversight of school boundaries?
My sense of reading the auditor's report is that it very strongly, I am in concurrence with all of the findings of the auditor's report, and that it has been increasingly, integration aid has increasingly been used as yet another source of funding among many to balance And in some ways, if you think about integration, aid going to schools that are becoming hyper-segregated, it is Orwellian in the sense of thinking about what these words mean. I see integration aid as supporting more integrative choices, so allowing kids more choices to try to overcome some of the barriers of housing segregation, lack of choice, hiring a diverse teaching staff to help deal with interracial schools. There's lots of schools that are becoming suddenly interracial, places like Richfield and East Bloomington and parts of Minneapolis and the older suburbs where you have very diverse kids and teachers that haven't had the training or the background to think about that, and both training teachers to think about a more multiracial society and thinking about that's not an easy task, and there's not as much training for that, and also thinking about trying to find funds for a more diverse education staff. These seem to be if you read the history of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the implementation by the Federal Department of Education in the early 60s when schools were becoming integrated, the classic uses of integration aid were to facilitate kids having experiences with each other, to reduce the tensions between kids of really different backgrounds when they're suddenly in contact with each other, to help teachers prepare themselves for a more multiracial classroom, to support activities and things where kids can make interracial contact that's sustained and meaningful. Because these are hard things. So, I think that schools increasingly need aid in the society. I have no qualm about the aid to education, but funds that are quote-unquote integration aid should further integration and the problems and the difficulties that sometimes accompany that. I think broadly the whole education system, you should think about the whole funding system. Now this is beyond your question, but it seems that you want to think about whether the funding system rewards integration or segregation. I think how you can have rules that adopt these and think about the development of cities and suburbs that moves toward a more integrated and less segregated society. These, I think, are all good goals.
Mm-hmm. And then, Mr. Chair, the charter schools, the voluntary integration schools, and other states regarding boundaries?
I think that charter schools, my view is that there's no reason that they should not be subject to the same rules as public schools are in terms of integration. I believe that Green versus New Kent County Board of Education suggests that putting the burden of integration on children is wrong. And this was in the South when the South was resisting the edicts of Brown or the efforts of Brown to integrate. Many kids, they created a freedom of choice plan. And they said schools are free to choice of any kids that want to go in, so that, you know, we have an all-white school and we're going to place the burden on the African-American kids to enter this school and integrate. And we'll also, the schools that are all black, white kids certainly can go to those. And the Supreme Court in Green versus New Kent County Board of Education said the burden is on the district, not the child, to integrate schools. I believe that's right. Now, I think if you think about this, I think the charter schools are a lot like what was happening in that very massive resistance in Virginia. They're saying, if you have an all-black Afrocentric charter school, you say whites are free to go to that. It's not too likely that's going to occur, just like it wasn't too likely that was going to occur in Virginia. And you have an all-white charter school that has a highly selective student body, and it's not too likely that a poor kid is going to do that. And I think that that is the right rationale to think about it. I think that another thing is if you have 20% of the kids in a public school system that aren't subject to civil rights rules, it's really going to undermine the efforts of the public schools to try to remain integrated. So I think the idea of charters is that they were going to compete, they were going to be a race to the top. And I think the experience has shown in 20 years or 15 years that they've been a race to the bottom. And they are fueling segregation rather than the idea was that they were gonna be integrated schools and that at least some people thought that they would be and that they would be more likely to be more integrated than the public schools, and that hasn't happened. And boundaries
and the voluntary integration schools, how successful
Well, I think that you can see that if you create the right incentives for school districts that they're participating. You have 9 or 10 western suburban districts that are participating voluntarily, and I think, I don't know, you'd have to talk to them, but I think the aid is probably a significant part of that. I think that places like Louisville and Raleigh that have had long-term rules have been much more integrated socially and racially to the benefit of the kids and the regions than places that have just sort of left it up to voluntary plans. I think that the state has pretty strong power to do this if it wants to. And the incentives, I would say, would be not only for kids to have a better chance and choice in their education, but also for older communities to be more stable and renewing. Not just the cities having a chance to renew themselves and be stronger socioeconomically, but these older suburbs that are part of the same pattern. The same things that will benefit kids will also help preserve the residential and social stability of the older communities over time. So I think that the state has the power to do this if it wants to, and I think the places that have done this, that have had pretty good guidelines, have had the most success. And if the voluntary programs are bad, I think the choice of yours is certainly better than not doing anything, I think it's had a good effect for kids. And I think it shows the way for the kinds of incentives that can make this suburban district think about participating.
And then the boundaries?
I think that school districts, I think the keys, a clear, hard reading of keys. And when school districts are making boundaries, having clear guidance, you know, when a school district makes a boundary decision that has a racially segregative impact, and a number of the other key factors are present, mobile classrooms, transfer policies, segregating staff, I think that there should be some pretty clear guidelines, because I think it's really hard for districts, if there aren't clear keys guidelines, to make those decisions. They almost always construe them against the kids of color. And I think keys was a really good decision in reading those decisions clearly. That was kind of the way that we used to do it. Now, the rule that we had in the 1970s and 80s was one district at a time, which I don't think was, thinking about the metropolitan area at the time, like Louisville, like Raleigh, like Nashville, like Knoxville, like Memphis. Not Memphis, but Chattanooga. Memphis didn't do this. I think when they thought about it as a region at the time, it was a very effective strategy. One district at a time is harder because people can just move outside of that one area. But I think reading keys, and there's a report that the Institute for Race and Poverty had on its website. I didn't bring it along. It talks about keys and talks about the factors. You know, if a school district is making a boundary decision that is having a racially segregative impact and a number of those other factors are present, there should be some guidance about that. It's really hard. Eden Prairie is the one district that I've seen that has tried to make a pro-integrative decision. There may be others. That's the one that I'm aware of. And it's been very hard for the people that wanted to do that to sustain themselves against the kind of really mounted effort. And I know this, representing Southwest Minneapolis, I know this to be the case. I know how hard it is when you have a really mobilized parent population that's really engaged and one that isn't, how hard it is to make a boundary decision that is integrative. It's almost impossible. Unless there's guidance.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would just say that when I was on the school board, we didn't make boundary changes, but we did make the decision to participate in a voluntary school. And it was very helpful to be able to say, you know, if we don't do this, St. Paul is going to sue us. You know?
Yes.
And so we were actually ahead of St. Paul and brought up the idea first, but we used that little fulcrum in our discussions.
Yes, and I think that from what I know about the decisions that were made in Osseo and Bloomington, I think, and I don't know very much about it. It's hard to know. It would be wonderful if the committee could find out what happened in those places, because it's really hard from the public record to know what happened. But I know that there were participants looking for guidance on this, and there wasn't very clear guidance.
And Mr. Chair, one final thing: when we did start that, you know, that was back in the 80s, I guess. It was your brother who was the speaker at the conference.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us school board members were at.
Yes, no, he had a very strong opinion on this, and I've been influenced by this. He said, I think when he testified, when charters were created, that this would happen. He predicted that they would be very segregated. They're much more segregated even than he predicted. Almost twice as segregated as he suggested that they would be. And the data that is there suggests they are underperforming the public schools, and only half of the charters are reporting data. So I think this is something that the committee should, the state should be well aware, should think about and study what's happening.
Any other questions? Do you want to continue your presentation?
One of the things I think is the thinking about these, this in the future, there are a number of integration districts that were created during the time of the NAACP's lawsuits, the North Suburban, Northwest Suburban Education District, the West Metro Education Partnership, the East Metro Education Partnership. These are all of the size that could have integrated schools over a long period of time, racially and socially. They all include diverse groups of places. At least in the West Metro Education System, there's been quite a bit of activity and partnership among those districts. It seems that these boundaries are thinking about these boundaries might be ways to move forward, thinking about empowering these boundaries to have some ability and influence in doing that. I also took a look at some ways that these might be reformed to think about this. Thinking about integrated district boundaries. The problem of racial and social integration in this, the Twin Cities metropolitan area, the second whitest and one of the most affluent regions, is not a huge problem if the region thinks about it together. And in places like Louisville, districts were, the legislature and many other places empowered these larger districts to have a larger role. And it was an action of state law, and it's to the great benefit of kids and communities. The state legislature has plenary power over these kinds of decisions in terms of thinking about the restructuring. And in the history of the state, Minnesota had been, really up until the 80s, one of the most proactive forces in the country on things like this. So thinking about these existing cooperation districts and thinking about thinking about other configurations and thinking about housing together. This is a problem that could be easily remedied within the course of a decade. You could eliminate racially and socially segregated schools if you wanted to. And it would be easier here than almost any place in the United States. And it's one of the places in the United States where people have done things like this before. Now, we've really moved in the opposite direction for about the last 12 or so years. We moved from a part of the country that had really virtually no segregated schools, so one that has three-quarters as many segregated schools as most big, diverse metropolitan areas. And we're moving on a strong path to catching up with Chicago and Milwaukee and Detroit and Cleveland. We're on that track. So it's the time in history, I think, is possible. You have not only the regulatory power of the Equal Protection Clause of the federal Constitution, but the Minnesota Constitution. In Connecticut, courts have used their state constitution to urge a more integrated system.
You can continue on your...
the points that I wanted to make, let me just sum them up, is that racial and social segregation are dramatically increasing here and catching up with the rest of the country. The state desegregation rule, as it's presently promulgated, is less rigorous than it could be under the Supreme Court's decision. The Supreme Court's decision in Seattle School says you can use race. You can't use it alone, but you can use it among other factors, as in higher education. The Supreme Court's decision also says that the proactive use of boundaries is permissible and won't be subject to strict scrutiny for the court. So the Supreme Court says that things like that Eden Prairie has attempted to do are not only permissible, but admirable. Federal law has enunciated in the Keyes case, it's much clearer about boundaries than the state school desegregation rule, which is based on a case based on the Green case. And I think the Keyes case is much clearer, and the rule could reflect Keyes and be stronger. Minnesota recognizes education as a fundamental right, which provides much stronger power to think about this than places that don't do that. In other states in the country, segregated schools have been found to violate the Equal Protection Clause of state constitutions. In Connecticut, the Connecticut State Supreme Court said that segregated education is fundamentally inadequate. We could do much more under the present state of federal law and certainly state law to make sure that schools are integrated. We could use a financing system to incentivize rather than to move the other direction. And it's possible. There are 16 metropolitan areas in the country that have done this for long periods of time. Raleigh, North Carolina, which is much more racially diverse than the Twin Cities, has had integrated schools across all of Wake County for 30 years. So it's quite possible to do this. This isn't the majority way of doing things. It isn't an easy way to do things. These aren't the typical metropolitan areas. But Minnesota has in the past not been a typical state. It's been a state that's been pressing on the front edge of things like racial inequality. And to follow the pack in such a way for such a long time is uncharacteristic of the way that this legislature and this state has thought about things like segregation.
Since the chair is busy over there, I'll just take license here and ask another question. Have you, your institute, worked with any school districts with any of these ideas, like, for instance, the integration districts?
We've studied it more than we've worked with them and trying to study it and understand how it works. It's not, in Minnesota, there are seven levels of local government that sit on top of each other, and understanding how all the financing and all the efforts go is a challenge in itself.
Well, it looks like we're decreasing on our workforce people here. We appreciate your comments, discussion, presentation, Representative Orfill, and we look forward to working with you in the future here. I'm going to, since we have like 12 minutes left, I'm going to open up the floor. I didn't want to do that in the beginning, but I guess we have time right now. If there's any questions from the audience that they would like to ask, I'm going to obtain two questions. And then we also have someone here who wants to speak on her behalf for like 4 minutes, so I'm going to give her time to speak too. So if there's anyone that has a question. Okay. I think we're moving forward. I think everybody's getting their questions answered. If Teresa Grahams would like to come forward. Thank you, Marvin. I really appreciate you. We will be discussing this later at a later time. Welcome to the committee. If you would address your name for the audio.
Thank you. My name is Teresa, T-E-R-E-S-A, Graham, G-R-A-H-A-M.
Okay, and you have about 4 minutes for your presentation or your discussion.
Okay.
Go right ahead.
I will just summarize because it is a little bit of a complex issue. Been very interesting to hear. First of all, I'm a clinical social worker and have been for the last 3 decades. I've spent about half my career working directly in schools. I've been a licensed school social worker also since 1978. Most recently, I served as the integration and equity coordinator for the Lakeville School District this fall in a new position that was created by the Minnesota rule this year to cooperate with the Burnsville School District. Burnsville is the racially isolated school district, and Lakeville was mandated to cooperate with them in the program. Burnsville has worked very hard for the last several months, has 5 paid staff people doing what I was doing, and has forged ahead with a really good plan. I was quite horrified to learn after I accepted this position that it was only because of political pressure that Lakeville had agreed to participate, and some of the things that were said today are very true in that regard. When I became aware of some concerns about some violations of the desegregation rule, I filed a written complaint with Minnesota Department of Education and have yet to hear from them whether they plan to investigate these concerns. The Office of Civil Rights in Chicago is looking into the matter. And one of the things I'm bringing to you as a question is to really look at the real-world implications of this rule and what's happening. Much of what Mr. Orfield and Ms. Lavarato said is very true in terms of research, but in the real world, how this is affecting children and the children that it's intended to affect is the bottom line of what you need to consider. Also, the oversight, the legislative auditor's report from 2 years ago, $85 million a year for the last 2 years and nothing has happened with this report is $170 million. Many school districts, I have personal knowledge, are using this money to plug the holes for the deficits they have. And that's the reality, and that's what's really happening. And you really need to be looking into this whole matter as I think, an issue that deserves consideration. Personally, I really think also this idea of metropolitan desegregation is something you really need to look at and be very proactive in these models. I recently attended the Magnet Schools of America conference in Washington, D.C., had a chance to talk with the people from Wake County in North Carolina and from school districts across the country who have done this. They are not a nirvana, but you really may need to look at this kind of plan in the future. I'm basically here today, though, because I do need some feedback from all of you, as I wrote to you earlier about the oversight of currently of this $85 million annually, what's being done with that money, and in some instances, it's not just inappropriate, but perhaps reckless and might even be criminal in some instances. So I need to talk with you individually also about these matters, and since I haven't gotten any response from the Department of Education and the other agencies that would have some both administrative and regulatory oversight to that. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of real-world perspective about what's happening with this program. And for districts that really don't want to participate but are mandated to participate and are not doing it in the intent with the intentions that it should have been, that the money was afforded to.
Well, thank you for your comments and your concerns. Representative Greiden, would you like to
thank you,
answer those
Chair,
questions?
And Ms. Graham, thank you very much for contacting us. I'm sorry we had a little time in the way there with people being out last week. I myself just read your email like 5 minutes before I came down here, so I'm guessing that the other members of the committee haven't seen it yet. But I would be very interested, when you do hear from the department, if you would share the response with us, or we could, you know, help you get a response so that we could, you know, factor that into the discussions that we have here with our committee. And it sounds like you are on the same track that, if I could speak for myself anyway, and hopefully the whole committee, that we are. We're sorry that it's been 2 years since we got the legislative auditor's report, and but we're glad that we're now getting to it. And, you know, the testimony that we've had so far, including yours, kind of points us in the same direction as far as what we should do. And, you know, for myself, I think at a minimum we should adopt the legislative auditor's report, and we actually have a staff member working on drafting it. I think, you know, Representative Dominguez may be interested in that bill, unless I'm speaking out of school.
Okay.
And then, you know, as the legislative session comes forward, we'll get as far as we can as the study committee, but then we'll have the bill that we'll take through the whole process, and hopefully you'll take a look at it and offer your input as we go along. So thank you.
I'd be very happy to share my extensive knowledge and experience in this regard, and I would encourage you to ask other people who are out there working in the real world to know how this impacts children to do so.
And that leads us into our next session that we were going to have. The third session is we're going to be inviting the districts and folks who want to come and testify on behalf of the integration revenue. Our next session is going to be just that. We're going to hear folks, again, the districts. Those of you who are here, tell your districts if they want to testify, please contact Shannon so we can get you on a list for testimony. So that's going to be our next session. So hopefully some of your questions and answers will be available at the time. I just got your email, just as well as Mindy Greiden, so we'll be looking over those emails also. So thank you for your comments. And
I
think if there's no other questions, comments, or concerns, I think we can adjourn. Thank you.